Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody. This is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of the Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular show and podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. I chose this interview because it tells a compelling human story that impacted me directly. My guest was author and Columbia University journalism professor Dale Maharaj, who wrote a book based on his dad's experience in World War II called Bringing Mulligan Home. Dale had related how he began a mission to find his dad's best friend's remains from the Battle of Okinawa and to try to bring them home. For those of us with relatives who served, it's a very familiar tale of how veterans coped with the scars of war. This story led to me seeking out the remains of my dad's best friend from World War II who died in a kamikaze attack on their ship during the Battle of Okinawa. My dad had sought to find where his remains were during his life, but couldn't do so. I did some investigation and found his grave located in Decatur, Illinois, which is about 2.5 hours from where my dad lived. So this book was an inspiration for me, and I hope you'll find it moving as well. This is the Best of Heartland Politics with Dale Maharaj, author of Bringing Mulligan Home. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heartland Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today, as we move into the Memorial Day holiday weekend, I thought it was appropriate and proper timing to feature an author and a book and a story that's particularly meaningful to me, and I think many listeners out there, whether they served in the armed forces or have family or friends who served, or just people out there interested in a really compelling story of discovery, hope, and ultimately peace, is the way I would describe it anyway. The book is called Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War, and the author is a friend of mine who I met several years back and had on this show previously. He's Dale Maharaj. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
It's great to be with you. I've not talked a lot about the book recently, so it's on my mind, as you can imagine, these days.
Yeah. Well, it's for our listeners, you know, we talk about the book, which was published in 2013, but there's some recent things that happened that are really, really interesting and emotional. As I come to this as a fellow son of a World War II veteran, but let me just kind of turn it over to you and who is Mulligan and then how did that play into how you came to write this book?
Well, I spent an 18-year quest to search for Mulligan, but it's actually, I'm 61, and it's probably about a 55-year quest, actually, because I grew up with a picture my father had in his shop in the basement of him and a buddy from the war. And my dad was very, very troubled man, had a lot of anger issues. And as a boy, I instinctively knew, don't ask about the war. But when he would talk about it, I would listen, of course. Well, when I was 12 or 13, he was hit by a drunk driver and I was on meds. And one night we were working in the basement shop, and he pointed to the picture, very emotional, and he says, "They blame me, but I didn't kill him. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault." And it's the only time he talked about the guy in the picture, didn't use his name that I recall, and then he died in 2000, and the picture went to California. The picture was in his life, in my life, as I grew up the entire time. So he took it to California, retired, and when he died in 2000, I was going in his bedroom drawer, and I found a tinier picture of him and the buddy, and it said H.W. Mulligan on the back. And so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for government records and got Mulligan's case file, and it listed his body as not being recovered. So then, in turn, I looked at the Japanese flag my father had in the drawer, signed by guys from his company. I started Googling those names, and I found five guys that I talked to, and I found out what happened. Mulligan, near the end of the Battle of Okinawa, threw a grenade into a tomb, and it was filled with Japanese munitions, and it exploded like a volcano, as one of the guys described it. And he was killed on that date. What was mystery was, why wasn't his body recovered? Was he buried in the rubble? And four of the five guys said, no, he was carried away, which made it an incredible mystery. But then my mother fell ill with cancer, and I kind of dropped it. And then I picked it up again a few years later. Long story short, somehow his his identification tag was torn off of his neck or wasn't on him, and it's probably why he was buried as an unknown. So I interviewed 29 guys from the company. I found the guy who carried Mulligan's body that day to the truck. A guy named Joseph P. Rossblock, who's still alive. I just talked to him a couple weeks ago for a couple of hours. Sharp as ever, carried Mulligan to the truck, and then his body was taken away. So the book comes out in 2013, and I'm on a show. I'm on Here and Now, the NPR show, and a genealogist in Virginia is listening. And so she emails me and said, I want to help find him. So I said, okay, great. We needed to have the family. I struggled to find Mulligan's family, survivors. I can't tell you how many, Robin, how many hundreds of phone calls I made. No luck, no luck. Well, this woman, after 6 months, amazingly found the cousin, the nephew of the cousin. Actually, I'm sorry. The Charlotte Observer did a story based on that. The story got around, and it ended up at this guy named Rob Rumsby. He's a veteran. He's one of these guys. I don't know if you've heard about this, Robin. They went to Tarawa after the government said all those Marines who died in the Battle of Tarawa, they're gone. The bodies were washed out to sea. They weren't looking for them. They went there with shovels, and they dug up dozens and dozens of Marines with their dog tags on their neck and brought their bodies home. He was one of those guys. He says, I want to help. And that began the second phase of this long, long quest. And it's a long story. I won't say it all here, but we had DNA. They exhumed last year, and they identified Mulligan earlier this year, and he's going to be buried August 21st at Arlington National Cemetery, not far from where my father is buried.
It's incredible. The book takes readers through all of this, except the recent what's happened more recently, which we can talk about a little bit. And I hope you don't mind, or listeners don't mind, my own reflection on this. When you mentioned the photo that your dad had, I remember as a kid growing up, my dad had a print of his ship on the wall. My dad served in the Navy. And also a picture of all the people that went through training at the training facility up north of Chicago. I can't remember the naval base north of Chicago. So I saw those, but I never asked about them. And my dad never talked about it until he started going to military reunions in the 1990s. So I just imagine other people, children of World War II vets, have similar types of experiences that as they hear this. And, of course, with our World War II veterans dying off every day, it's important that these stories get told. I thought it was really interesting the quote your dad had. There's no heroes, only survivors. Our culture plays up these wars in ways that aren't really accurate. Talk about that a little bit, and especially the section where you interview 12 Marines and just how they depicted this battle, especially the Battle of Okinawa.
Well, he's not the kind of veteran who put on his old uniform and went to the parades. He hated that. He hated memorials. He hated anything that lionized the war. My father was not a highly educated man, but he had his own brilliance, in my view, on this. And that quote that you read, he told that to me dozens of times. Never, it was not just a one-time thing. He felt very strongly about that. He didn't glorify war at all. And when I found the 29 other guys, I basically, for most of them, I was interviewing my dad. None of them. One of them went to parades and stuff. A few of them wore the 6th Marine Division caps and such. But the vast majority of them were, my editor was worried when I started the book. He said, he later told me, he said, I thought you were going to write an anti-war screed. I did. I let the guys speak. And as my editor said, you're not anti-war. They're anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very proud when my editor said that, because when I do my work, I really want to channel the people I've gotten to know. Some of these guys I got to know for years, and I want to do their stories right. And there was guys like Tom Price in L.A. who was amazing. And he says, you know, Dale, I read about the war and after I was out, and after Iwo Jima, that disaster at Iwo Jima, why was the Battle of Okinawa not fought differently? He said, they just put us on that island and marched us down into a trap. And he says, we were basically cannon fodder. He was bitter about it. This wasn't a rah-rah, and it wasn't necessarily anti or pro anything. It was just reality. So I tried to capture that when I did these interviews. I wanted their voices to be telling that story, not me. And some of them, like, oh my God, like Mr. Lockridge in Georgia, confessed to war crimes, ripping teeth out of bodies, gold teeth out of bodies, shooting Japanese so they would suffer. And he says, if you you're treated like an animal, leave like an animal, you're going to act like an animal. And he was like, it felt like a confession to me. And at one point he said, I'm glad somebody's putting it down like it really was. And he died not long after. It really was a deathbed confession. So I felt honored, humbled and honored that these men allowed me to tell their stories. And they were so open and honest with me.
I read Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation. I liked it, but I thought it was a little too on the other side of this issue. My dad had read it as well. I bought it for him as a Christmas gift, and he was similar to the way your dad was. I mean, there's a side of war that these individuals saw. Both of our dads were what? My dad was 17. Your dad was a similar age.
They go, 18, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they go over there, and they came back, and this wasn't anything that they were, again, as your dad said, it wasn't heroes, and they live with this and just went on with their lives. And I just think that's really interesting how again, you portrayed it through the words of these Marines, the way my dad described war. It's tough. I mean, some of the things in this book are really difficult to read, but they're reality.
Yes, I've had veterans of today's wars read the book and comment and talk about the reality of it, and they relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard from a lot of the children of, like our generation. Oh my God, I can't tell how many dozens of handwritten letters, emails of, that's my father in that book. So it's a pretty universal and tough experience. I felt to get it down and do it honestly and not in a rah-rah. I wanted three dimensions. I didn't want one or two dimensions in this book.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on KBURAM-FM 1490, 99.3, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we're talking today with Dale Maharaj, who is the author of Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He got the prize in 1990 for a book called And Their Children After Them. He writes some for the Nation magazine, and all he teaches at Columbia University, a professor in journalism. And I will say, your writing at the Nation, I love it. You do a lot of traveling, and you capture things going on in this country at the local level very well, which I appreciate. You talk in the introduction that this book is is for children of veterans, and again, it connected to me in that way. I wanted to talk about Okinawa. Your dad was there. My dad was on a ship that was hit by a kamikaze plane during Okinawa. And it talks about how, and again, this doesn't fit maybe with the narrative of how we look at the war, but the subject of prisoners, whether they took prisoners of war or not.
Oh, there were no prisoners taken. They were executed over and over and over. At the very end, a very tiny handful were taken prisoner. I have a scene where the captain of the company, Captain Hagler, who took over from Captain Lanigan, they had two prisoners, and he ordered a Marine to take them back to the trucks. and there were two shots as soon as I got over the hill, and the soldier came back and said, oh, they tried to escape, so I shot him. And Hagler said, they didn't try to escape, but he couldn't do anything. There was that much vitriol and enmity towards the soldiers. Conversely, by that point, the Japanese, they had no capacity to take. So it was an island of no prisoners. It was all-out war. 110,000 civilians died in our bombing. 110,000 Japanese soldiers died. The toll I'm having a senior moment on the American toll. Like 20, I mean, it was stunning. It was 20 some thousand. I mean, it was a stunning amount of death. 250,000 people total dead on that island. 12,000 U.S. dead. That's right. I'm getting my memory back here.
Yeah, 12,520.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're better than I am.
I got the book.
I'm looking at it. I should have it open. It was the carnage was stunning, and it was the smell of death, the descriptions, and I went to the island, of course, for almost 2 weeks in doing the research for the book, and I went to every place the battles happened, and the burial tombs and the Japanese caves that were bricked in, with bodies inside, and just stunning. And years before, I was in the Manila Cemetery where a lot of the war dead are buried. That's where Mulligan, actually, his body turned out to be. And I was there during the fall of Marcos. I covered the revolution. But I had to go to that cemetery and see, and just the vastness of those crosses. It's stunning. I can't comprehend the scale of it.
It's that section of the book where you actually go to Okinawa and walk in the same area as your dad walked in. That was must have been kind of an almost haunting experience, to actually be there years later. And you discuss that in the book. I don't want to give too much of that away, but in the very location where Mulligan was killed.
Oh, I found the tomb, the blown up tomb. It's still there. It's amazing. I kept going back and back and back in those weeks, of course, and it got pretty intense. I that's all I'll say. I can't even. I think in the book, I get some sense of the haunting, searing moment that was to be there. But I wonder if I did justice with words, just how much that affected me.
It's interesting because we all look at this generation, that generation of veterans, and the common theme among most all of them was they didn't talk much about the war. And I guess when you read books like this, and we've heard it directly from those veterans, my dad when he was alive, you kind of understand why. That my dad's best friend was killed on the ship when the kamikaze struck. And it's not something you just come back and start talking about. It's scars that are carried with them and then are kind of almost incorporated in the children's lives.
Did your dad didn't talk about that, buddy, did he, or did he?
No. He didn't talk about it much at all. And finally, I had a reporter friend of mine come over and interview him because I talked him into it just because of his unique experience of serving both in Korea and World War II. And he finally talked about it, but he got very emotional every time he did, and he said that's why he didn't. It was a very difficult thing to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, he was one of those guys who got into Korea as well.
Yeah.
Those guys, there was one guy in my dad's company who did both, and two of them, and I mean, Korea was its own horror and a whole different – that's another story, obviously. But I don't know how they did it.
Yeah, it's the incredible story that my dad always told was how he was taught to just hate the Japanese during World War II, and then he was injured in Korea and wound up convalescing in Japan, and he remarked to me how friendly and nice the Japanese people were. And it built up in him more of a rage towards – and you discussed this as well – his superiors in the military and some of these tough-talking politicians who talk about war very flippantly and that have no idea about the true costs of war.
Well, I'm seeing the veterans today, and I have an appreciation for them, always did, but triply more so now. I had a veteran from Iraq who had traumatic brain injury from a roadside bomb a couple years ago. Wonderful young man. I get so emotional when I talk to these guys because we keep doing this over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's a place for war. I'm not a total peacenik, but it's a very limited place, and it's not something we should do casually or flippantly. And we don't like in the modern wars, so that's on a whole other show, Robin. But anyway, I appreciate these veterans of all wars in a way that I never did before after all this work.
I agree. And just again, listeners out there, nobody, this isn't an anti-war screed by either of us. It's based on talking to veterans, and they're the ones that have voiced this, these feelings. And that's why I encourage people to read this book and reach out to World War II veterans, other veterans that are out there, and hear about those experiences directly. What was really striking to me was when I read that New York Times piece that featured you and when Mulligan's remains were found. It was emotional, and not because I obviously, you and I have never met, but we've talked on the phone a lot, and but there was just a connection there that you and I talked about over email that was interesting that you felt with other children of World War II veterans.
Oh man, well I went down to the family notification for Mulligan when the military came and notified them. And Rob Rumsby, the veteran, I says, we got to have a drink at my dad's grave. You know, I don't celebrate very much in my life. It seems like something like a quest like this. And basically, I was finishing my father's unfinished business. You don't get to do that, you know. So I said, we got to mark this. I don't normally do this, but I'm going to come down. Let's have a drink at my dad's grave. And so the New York Times reporter, I told him about this. He says, would you mind if I came? And I know Dave, the reporter, and I said, sure. I knew Dave would be respectful and cool. So we went down. It was a very, oh my God, it was an amazing day to go. It was Easter Sunday this year, and Easter Sunday only falls on April 1st, like a few times a century. 1923, 1938, 1945, 1956 and this year are the only times it's fallen on April 1st. Well, the Battle of Okinawa started Easter Sunday, April 1st, 1945. Mm-hmm. So we were at the cemetery at my dad's grave on Easter Sunday, April 1st, anniversary of the battle, and I had a bottle of very good, respectable whiskey, as the reporter called it. And as I learned, something, I did a book on riding the rails with the new homeless back in the 80s. These were the people who lost their jobs in the factories and they ended up being hobos. But I also met a lot of the old hobos from the Great Depression who were still on the rails. And they had a tradition. When you opened a bottle of liquor, you did not take a drink. You spilled a little on the ground for those who are now beneath it. So I took that hobo custom and I poured some whiskey on the grass at my dad's grave, and I said, the dead drink first. And then we drank from the bottle. We got, I'll admit it, we got pretty toasted. And, and you know, somebody mentioned, would this consider disrespectful? And I said, my father would have, if somebody comes here and yells at us, I'll use the language my father would use.
Yeah.
And I said, it won't be pretty. But, you know, my dad would want us drinking at his grave. And so it was the ultimate respect. I felt very I hate that word closure. It's a psychobabble word.
You
don't get closure.
No.
My dad still had traumatic brain injury. Your dad still was tortured by the war. You don't get over things, but you deal with them. And I think that's what I was celebrating, dealing with the physical act of bringing Mr. Mulligan home and putting a name on his grave for his family, for my father, and understanding my dad's anger and rage a whole lot more than I did 18 years earlier. So it was one of those rare moments in life where you really get to feel it.
You know what's interesting too is I'm just here listening to you, and I've always found this as well with my dad. It seems like veterans, there are certain days that stand out to specific veterans more than, like, I mean, we're all familiar with Memorial Day, Veterans Day, VJ Day, VE Day. But every April 6th, my dad would wake up and tell my mom and us kids later, do you know what today is? And after a while, we finally remembered, but it was the day that his ship was hit by the kamikaze in Okinawa, April 6th. That day's meaningless to other people. Your day would be April 1st. And again, it's kind of your own little, I guess, days of memory relating to our loved ones and what they their experiences in the war.
Right, right. No, I think it's more human, more real for us to find our own ways to express grief or remembrance. Memorial Day, you know, I respect those who find it as a moment, but you know, it's not my moment. I have another point of the year that's my moment, but you know, it doesn't. You have your day, April 6th. It doesn't matter, you know, in the end, if the remembrance is there and it's honored in its own way. It's all the same in the end.
Now, is this your book? I think you mentioned to me is going to be republished with a new foreword by you. Is that correct?
Oh, I've got all kinds of news. I'm really excited about two things. The first is Amazon's Audible, the publisher. I know him, and I've been telling him about this quest over the years, and he's been fascinated by it. And when I told him that Mulligan looks like he was going to be identified last year, he says, I want to buy a podcast. So I'm going to do a 5 to 6 hour podcast for Audible on Mulligan. And I have 100 and some hours of recorded interviews with the veterans. I've even got interview. I got even audio of me and my father fishing in the '90s. And so I'm going to do a podcast. It's going to be very much different than the book, a whole different creature. My publisher is very excited about reissuing the book with a new afterword. So I'm going to write a whole new afterword about the post-book quest to find Mulligan. It's quite a story. I told Rob, I think I'd wear the ragtag crew. I said, is that an insult? He says, that's an honor. A veteran the military hates, this genealogist, this hippie genealogist in Virginia, Mrs. Patterson, the widow James, who provided the DNA that found Mulligan. We just worked tirelessly for years. There were dentists volunteered. I mean, it was total, on the ground ragtag. And then we got the military to exhume, and the family applied political pressure, which was extremely important because the military unit. That looks for the. They don't exhume very many bodies every year. I think they did 200 last year, and that's up from 100 the year before. So there's been pressure on them. So everything came together. That story is gonna be. I'm looking forward to telling it.
I'm looking forward to reading that afterward, and then the podcast I didn't know about. So that'll be good. That'll be good as well. That's it. I think we could talk more, but I'm out of time. I'm a little over here, but I really appreciate, well, obviously the work you did on this book, which is important for all of us, and really it struck such a chord with me, and I'm personally appreciative, and so I'll be anxious to see what else read your new afterword, and I encourage all of our listeners to, not just this Memorial Day, but any time. Sit down and talk and listen to these veterans that are dying a lot these days and hear what they have to say directly from them. I think it's worthwhile.
I'll just say amen to that.
Well, thank you, Dale, for taking the time to be with us today. And again, thank you for this journey you've shared with all of us.
Once again, it's a pleasure.